You're listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental.
TMZ, oh my goodness.
I'll let Bobby Warsaw tell me how I did it.
I think he's the philosopher of football.
I'd like to have some more derbies.
Absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, I like it. I liked it a lot.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Welcome, everybody, to Extra Time, driven by Continental from the AT&T MLS Studios in Manhattan. I'm David Goss, alongside Kalen Carr. And Kalen, we thought this was going to be a full show. I thought we were going to have a packed midfield, four hosts. We were going to high press, cover ground, and all of a sudden, we get into warm-ups. Andrew Wiebe's out sick.
Yeah.
Matt Doyle, injured ankle. We don't even know what the timetable is. I can't even fathom how Matt Doyle gets an injury like a rolled ankle.
This is one of those things where you show up to preseason camp and you're like, oh, we had a visa issue, but only from like the best places.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, it's in Brazil still. It's have trouble getting in. And you missed the fitness test. You missed the double days.
Oh,
the
no.
Beginning part. And then you're like, oh, hey.
I'm here for shaping
back.
When we do warm up.
So
games.
Well played, Matt and Andrew.
So with Matt Doyle, I'm thinking one fell off a treadmill.
Because
he doesn't do contact sports.
That sounds unlikely already.
Potentially. My second theory was almost stepped on one of his cats, had to make like last minute adjustment.
Way more likely.
Probably has a bunch of stuff on his floor, slips, rolled ankle. He's
probably
off
has
his
a
feet
bunch
for
of stuff
3 days.
On his floor. What do you think? Like maybe like old VHS
Stacks.
Tapes of like 1997 yeah. San Jose Clash.
Stacks of old newspapers and magazines in Doyle's apartment.
Okay.
Stacks of it. Of yeah. Just like, oh, remember this one time? The San Jose Mercury mentioned the, you know, San Jose Clash 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I've got that newspaper in my apartment. That's my guess about Doyle.
Wow.
For Wiebe, apparently, stomach thing, you know, I think you're supposed to stop at that. You're not supposed to describe more because then people can imagine what he looks like doing all those things. So we put in a request for a pool goalkeeper because of this emergency issue, and someone at MLS player personnel, I don't know, Aleko Eskenmarian, something like that, he denied it. So we don't have that to go in.
We already used Darius Barnes.
We were going to try and pull an emergency player up from our USL team, but apparently that's also been denied. So, Kalen, it's us, baby.
Dude, I was just at the rookie symposium, and there's hungry players there. I could have brought one or two back, helped out. I'm not sure all of them are going to get signed. I'm hoping, at least my group. It was me, Andre Akpan, and Pat Ayani, and we had a little group. So we're like, hey, guys,
Whoa. We
need, I guess Brendan Aronson was in that group with Pat last
nice.
Year. So we need like a lot of success from that group.
Right, so two things. One, we will have Matt Doyle on the phone later on. We're going to talk U.S. soccer. Of course, Brian McBride hired as GM, and a lot of stuff going on at the youth ranks. You remind me of that because Patrick Ayani, U.S. U23, U20 legend.
Absolutely.
Also, speaking of up and coming, who's your next up-and-coming media star from this class?
Well, I don't know about media, but
who's going to be the one who's going to be the one who does interviews and we're like, that guy's a legend?
Well, I honestly, the kid I was most impressed by, and he's actually not a rookie. He already played, but he was in my group, was Edwin Cerrillos.
FC Dallas love.
FC Dallas, yeah. He very mature, and he just had, I don't know, there's just something about quiet, confident. And he was actually, I mean, the really cool thing about this rookie symposium is you get such a good opportunity to get to know these players. He missed it last year, I guess, but came in. But his insight was way more valuable than anything that I was providing.
Nice.
He was talking to guys about what's it like to be in the locker room. And then we had a whole bunch of people from the players union as well as MLS side. So it was, like you said, Aleko was there. But then the players union
That's
had
why he was denying
Luis Robles and Nick Raimondo,
nice.
Nick Lima, Joe Cannon, Jimmy Conrad. We had so many players there that were able to give their experience and really help these kids start off their career. So it was a cool thing. A
lot of goalkeepers.
Yeah,
goalkeepers
yeah.
union.
Not usually the people you want to take advice
yeah,
from,
right.
but in this case, these were the wisest ones we could find.
Well, I look forward to welcoming you into ETR season preview for 2031 and having Edwin Cerrillo be our guest.
Dude, he's big things this season, Edwin. Let's go.
Speaking of big things, we need to talk a little bit about, I guess not big, the little P, Chicharito, the Mexican national team legend. Reports from Marca in Spain are that the LA Galaxy front brass is meeting with Chicharito today to discuss a potential transfer coming up. Jeff Carlisle, Tom Marshall, Kevin Baxter, they've all heard rumors as well that the two parties are at least talking to each other. And this is massive.
Yeah.
in an offseason where we've had a ton of huge moves for Major League Soccer, this could be the biggest one because Chicharito, after your man, your homie.
Is this? Oh.
I'm saying, do you want to, it's your name to mention. I mean, who's the greatest Mexican national team player?
Oh, El Cuau.
In modern history. Cuauhtemoc Blanco. Since he retired or stopped playing with the national team in the mid-2000s, I'd argue Chicharito is the biggest Mexican national team star of the last 10 years, and he could be on his way to Major League Soccer, not just to MLS, but to LA.
No, it's massive. I mean, when you look around and you go to any Mexican national team game and you see which jerseys are in the crowd, it's invariably a ton of Chicharito, the star power, everything that, you know, playing at Manchester United and on all the big clubs that he's been in Europe playing for. It's like, he would be massive. And it goes again. It's every year. I think before the offseason started, I was sitting here the last time I was on the show, and I think the rumor started floating around, and we're like, oh, this happens every year. Come on. Like, why are we still tricking ourselves into believing this? But this is starting to smell like it might happen. And for the Galaxy, it's the logical place. It would really, I think, as last year, El Tráfico for me was the story of the season. Zlatan leaves. You wonder how it's going to sort of, how it's going to exist in the next iteration.
Because as a whole, it was huge, but it really came down to Zlatan versus Vela individually in the last matchup of that was the theme. That was the storyline. Them being quoted about each other, them facing off against each other.
Absolutely. But now this has a whole different vibe to it.
Oh,
right?
My God.
Because you have the two Mexican national team biggest stars with Vela and Chicharito going at it in LA for El Tráfico. I think that would be amazing.
Jonah Dos Santos, a part of that as well. It would be a huge move for Chicharito, 31 years old, has only started four times at Sevilla this year where he signed from West Ham. And he said specifically, playing time is a reason I'm going to Sevilla. He hasn't gotten that playing time. 31 as well. You're still in your prime. You can still do some damage the next place you go. He still wants to be a part of the national team. Tata Martino has called players up from MLS. He respects the level in MLS. It seems like now is the time, and I think, you know, in December, we all were like, eh, but then you hear LA, you look at the roster, you look at his age, his profile, and you think, this actually is extremely realistic.
Well, and you look at what happened with Carlos Vela last season. Like, I think that really plays a big role into his perception or the perception overall. And these things tend to have compounding effects. And you mentioned Tata, but I think also Juan Carlos Osorio before that, bringing Vela to the World Cup and his success there. And then you look even behind that, where you say Gio came early, right? And then Jonah was like, came. And then Vela comes. And all these guys are friends, and they share experiences. You see what's happening. You see how, frankly, just how happy Vela is, how he's enjoying his football. He's playing his best self. And for a guy that's maybe falling into a situation outside, in at his club, where he's not playing, he's not getting that ability to really be that leader, that guy who's going to get all the goals, this becomes more and more appealing.
And it has, LA Galaxy have built a team that is just missing a number nine. They have guys, obviously, in Christian Pavone, who might be the best winger in the league. And now they bring in Katai, who's an experienced creative player. They've got Jonah Dos Santos. They've got Corona. They've got Legette behind you. They need a guy who's just going to pour in goals. They don't need a guy to do a lot more. Yep. That's why Chicharito here, like this fit, you know, if he had gone to Chicago, which was the other big rumor, he would have been, you know, he would have to be the Lodero. He would have to be the Almirón, where everything goes through him. He's the one you play through. That's not who he is. This is who he is. And if he shows up in LA, I mean, if he's healthy this year, he's scoring 15 to 20 goals easy in this group.
I agree. I put it north of 20. I think 20 would be the mark, but I think he can go above 20 this season just based on his quality. When you look around, you see Joseph Martinez, you see himself, Vela. I think that group will be probably leading the goal scoring charts next year if this does happen. And if you look at the balance on both sides from Katai and then Pavone, the one thing they needed was a number nine that had a high work rate, but didn't really need to stretch to the wide areas because they're going to be handling that. But his movement, his tenacity in the box, he would be the perfect number nine for what the Galaxy need with that system. Not just off the field, the, you know, marketing ability, but on the pitch, his profile as a player would suit that system very well.
You mentioned the off the field stuff, the popularity. LA, the biggest Mexican national team star, playing in that city week in and week out. And then also he goes on tour. You've been part of the Rockstar concert tour with Cuauhtemoc Blanco. Take us a little bit into what this experience would be like for the LA Galaxy as a club and for those players alongside him if he does come in this year?
Well, they're used to it. Right? The Galaxy have the infrastructure, the framework to support that type of player because that's just what that club has always been about. But it was crazy. I mean, Blanco wasn't just in Chicago filling the stadium. It was everywhere. It was actually, L.A. was the biggest reception we had. When we got to LAX, it was like hordes of people at the airport who found out what time our flight was arriving. And this is after Blanco had been in MLS for like, it wasn't like a new signing or a player announcement. This was just, and that was the way it was everywhere we went. People at airports leaving their jobs, quitting their jobs, literally just to go take a picture, like jumping away from their, whatever they were doing. And then even just around, like, the craziest part was when we went to Mexico. And I don't want to go too deep into the story, but it is amazing. And there, we went and played at, we were at Necaxa, and we were at training one day, and a guy showed up in a Club America Volkswagen Beetle car, and it was painted, like, all over.
Yeah.
He takes off his shirt. He's got a portrait tattooed of Blanco, just his face. It was super awkward on his back shoulder.
Yeah.
And then he had another one of him doing the, like, Aguila celebration. And so he signs his, he has him to sign his arm, and he's got this huge autograph. It says Cuauhtémoc. I mean, it's a long name. It covers his entire forearm. And the next day he comes back tattooed.
Yes. Had to be done. Had to be done. Which means we are on the verge of bringing another star to Major League Soccer in Chicharito, who could be garnering tattoos. There are very few players in MLS that force people to get tattoos of their name. Chicharito could be that guy. And Kalen, one last big question about this. You said 20-plus. You think he's going to be arguably the best goal scorer in Major League Soccer?
Well, is my mic on? Hold on one second.
Your headphones are out.
Oh, okay. Good. Hold on a second. I'm like all over the place.
You guys, Andrew Wiebe's sick. Matt Sorrell has a broken ankle. And now Kalen's going to go AWOL on me.
I was like, we've only got two guys on the show, so I cannot mess this up. Do I think he'll be the best striker in MLS?
Yeah.
No, I think Joseph Martinez. Yeah, I'm not going to leave that one. But
you still think 20 plus goals?
Yeah, I think 20 plus goals. I think I think 20 would be the sort of like marker. I think he'll go as far as, for me, as whether it would be living up to the expectation of a signing of this profile that would command this type of figure, probably to bring him in and to pay him. But I think absolutely he'll be in that class. Where he's, I think him and Joseph could push each other throughout the season, and Vela as well, with the multitude of ways that he can score goals. But
this one signing left, let's say they make this one signing, that's it. Are the Galaxy in the conversation as favorites, contenders, chance at MLS Cup? Where would you put them with this group? That
I think always contenders. I don't know if they. I would say contenders maybe for MLS Cup. I still think there are maybe other teams like LAFC that I think have a better chance at the Supporters Shield that might be built maybe more that way. But when I think of even Scalotto being able to imprint the way that he wants to play with this team, he likes hardworking, industrious number nines that are hungry for goals. He's everywhere. He's managed. He's had that ability to bring that out of him. And then be able to add these nice pieces around it. His team and his vision is starting to really take shape. It was very difficult, obviously, when you have a guy like Zlatan to...
Who scored in Serie A, by the way. That guy's pretty good.
Yeah. But he was the opposite of that in a lot of ways. And I think even in the locker room, Chicharito is more of a soft-spoken guy. I think he leads maybe more by example, his work rate. But Zlatan was such a big figure that it all kind of had to fit around him. So even in the locker room, I think this could make this team a much better team as the way it functions throughout the season, which is super important.
You mentioned it with GBS, coached at Argentina, had like true Argentine number nines, guys that work hard, don't need a lot of the ball, and then score goals. That's Chicharito to a T. This could be really special. This could be really exciting. But don't just take our word for it. Let's talk to the man himself, Paul Tenorio, at The Athletic, a little bit more about Chicharito and what's going on around Major League Soccer. Paul, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, guys.
And we have established on ETR that if you say something, it's a report. Of course, if Sam says it, it's a rumor. So we are here for all those good reports, Paul. And let's start with what we've been talking about the entire show. Chicharito, we said it, the largest star of the Mexican national team, potentially coming to MLS. We discussed it as if it was going to happen. Paul, could you maybe help us a little more on details of what actually is going on?
Sure. So from what I know, there are representatives from the LA Galaxy in Spain right now trying to finalize the deal. And that is significant because going back as far for me personally as 2015, there have been reports of interest from MLS teams in Chicharito. When I was in Orlando, Orlando City made a run at him in 2015. There have been connections with the LAFC and the Galaxy before, Chicago Fire last year. And for the most part, that was kind of one-way interest. Chicharito was much more interested in staying in Europe and continuing his career there. Now every indication is he's willing to talk and he's willing to come to Major League Soccer, and it's going to come down to the finances. How much money are they willing to pay? What will the personal terms look like, and what does the transfer look like? I'm a little bit surprised that it's the Galaxy, but only because every indication I had last year and even after the season in the late fall was that the Chicago Fire kind of had Chicharito. Taylor Twellman described it as discovery rights on Chicharito. That's not what it was, but it was kind of let's say the league would benefit from Chicharito being in Chicago for the relaunch of the Chicago Fire brand. And I think other teams kind of that might have had interest heard that as well and were kind of hands off. So credit to the Galaxy, who said, you know what, we're going to be aggressive and go get this deal done for us, for LA.
With the rumors around Chicago, the interest, and in some ways the void that's still there waiting to try and figure out who they may sign to help usher in this new era going back to Soldier Field, what are you hearing out of Chicago? Is there any movement? Is there any other signing? And what type of profile of signing would they be looking for? I know the technical staff is very experienced in Europe, but with Chicharito being a great example, and then Blanco before him, what type of signing do you anticipate them making?
Well, it's complicated. First of all, this new front office has a very limited amount of time to put together a good majority of a roster. And, you know, when Nelson Rodriguez finished up last season, he kind of said, I did this on purpose. I wanted a new GM to have a blank slate to work with, have a good cap situation, which on one hand is like a nice idea, but on the other hand, it's very difficult to sign three designated players and multiple TAM players in one window to have a team ready to be competitive at the start of the season. From what I'm hearing from sources around the league and in Chicago, they're looking across the board. They have three DP spots to fill. They obviously have multiple TAM spots to fill. They're looking certainly in Europe. I think there is a profile of an Eastern European player that they believe could do well with the Chicago market, but also that in positions they think could translate well in the league. That's at that number six spot, especially. I think they may end up looking for a center back. They're certainly in the market for a right back. And then, you know, what do they end up? The big question is, what do they end up doing at the number 10, the number 9, and at the number 7? Those are three really important positions, all of which are going to require some spending. And do they look to Mexico, to Latin America, to try to put some butts in the seats as well as to change the on-field results? Maybe. We've heard a lot of different names connected. All of them, the bigger names, are big money players. And I think that's important to know about Joe Mansueto. He is going to want to spend money. And so the pressure now is to get it right. And I think that is where we're going to see. I think that's going to determine whether or not we see those signings in January or in the summer. Because if you're going to spend $10, $15 million or maybe more on a player, you better be sure about him. And I think that's kind of where Chicago stands right now. They're having discussions with some bigger name players, some like Matic, a name that's been connected. I do understand that there has been interest there. You know, big profile European experience. You know, they have been looking in Mexico as well. You know, what younger players, more in their prime players, they're looking at everything. It's just a matter of, can they find the right player for the right price? And can they do it now? And I think that last part's going to be the hard part.
You mentioned for Chicago, you know, GM coming in late, technical staff coming in late has maybe pushed their timeline. But it's been odd. While some teams have been aggressive, we've seen a lot of teams kind of be slow in this window. Seattle Sounders, one that a lot of people thought would solidify their lineup and push into CCL. They haven't really made any moves. You look at New York Red Bulls. You look at the Montreal Impact. Why do you think some of these groups have been slower in this offseason?
Well, I think the big reason is the thing that's looming over every team, and that's the CBA and the league. And, you know, putting aside the idea of kind of the biggest picture discussions and people talking about work stoppage and all that stuff, really gets down for teams to the nitty-gritty of the salary rules and what are those going to look like. It becomes very difficult to sign players when you don't know if TAM is going to exist, how much TAM you're going to have. Is it going to be converted into general allocation money, or is it going to go into the salary budget? Now we have, based off of Sam's reporting, and I'll confirm it so that we can call it a report, not just a Sam's faithful rumor, but you know, the discussions around the third designated player spot, that changes everything on how you look at players. I mean, let's look at the Fire, for example. Why are they taking their time on designated players? Or, you know, it's not just about the right match and the right money. They also have to think, okay, if we're going to sign a designated player who is 30 or 31 or 25 or 26 even, that means we only have one more DP spot available potentially, because in 2021, that third DP spot has to be a young DP. So, you know, you have to be really careful if you're looking at guys who are over the age of 23 right now, that you have a plan for those players and you have a plan for that second DP spot, and then that you are finding the right player for the third DP spot down the road. So there is a knockdown effect of what are these rosters going to look like this year, but they're trying to plan for what they're going to look like in 2021 as well. And so I think we're seeing a lot of teams hold up on their designated player signings. I think we're seeing a lot of teams that aren't sure. You know, you look at a guy like Justin Merrim. Why is he still available? Well, he's a guy that's right there on that fringe. Is he going to be a TAM level player or not? And, you know, is TAM going to exist or not? Well, signing him to a $500,000 deal or $550,000 per year deal might be a good deal if TAM exists, because it's more cap friendly. But if TAM goes away, then maybe you can get him closer to what would be his a more realistic value for him. You know, take some money out of his pocket, unfortunately, but, you know, is a little bit more cap friendly for the team. So, you know, those types of decisions are happening all over the league with free agents, with TAM level players, and with DPs. And it all goes back to the CBA and not knowing what the roster rules are going to look like.
This show supports putting the most money in Justin Merrim's pocket as humanly possible. That way we can go get Persian food together. I can make him pay. But coming off that, you mentioned that DP rumor. You mentioned Sam Stashkull's rumors and then now your reports. What do you make of what that move would do for the league? What do you think of the idea?
I am not a fan of the idea, largely because I think it's, I think this is a league that has put so many restrictions on how teams spend their money. And you have the real reason that this is being done is to maintain parity within MLS. And I think the league is going to have to make a decision soon. And the decision is, do we want to be truly competitive with Liga MX? Do we want to put ourselves really on a path to be competitive with the European leagues down the road? Or are we more concerned with whether every fan base feels they have a chance to win an MLS Cup at the start of a season and throughout a season? And I think they can dress it up how they like, but the reality is this is a way to limit the highest spending teams and how they spend their money. And it's done to benefit the teams who aren't able to or willing to spend as much until they see their revenues go up. I think ultimately it would be bad for the league in the long term. I think taking any type of money out or restricting those three designated player spots gets you into dangerous territory of having to turn down a signing like, for example, Chicharito, because you already have two DPs who are over age, quote unquote. You know, how would that be good for the league? I think you look at back at some of the better teams that we've seen in this league over the last decade, you know, was the LA Galaxy with Landon Donovan, Robbie Keane, and who was the third DP?
David Beckham.
Omar Gonzalez at one point was the third DP. You look at Toronto FC, Sebastian Giovinco, Michael Bradley, Jozy Altidor. Was that team bad for the league? I don't think so. And so I just think it's an attempt to create parity at the sacrifice of the bigger goals for the league. And, you know, ultimately, I think it's, you know, we go down to this discussion every year about the playoffs and what the format looks like and how many teams are getting in. As long as the playoffs exist in Major League Soccer, it doesn't matter how much every team is going to have a shot at MLS Cup. Every team is going to have a shot at MLS Cup because, especially right now when it's a one-and-done postseason structure, all it takes is one bad game at home, which LAFC experienced last year, and now all of a sudden one of the highest spending and best teams in the league is out. So, you know, I think the playoffs themselves create a level of parity that will keep every fan base interested, and you can still support the owners who want to go and spend aggressively.
Paul, you started the reporting that Inter Miami might be bringing in a big designated player over the next few days, weeks, in Roger Martinez from Club America, Colombian international at 25 years old, at a pretty big number. We've heard a lot of reactions since then, including on this show where I am wildly in favor, and everyone tells me that I am hyperbolic about it because I'm extremely excited. Do you think this gets done? But more importantly, what do you think of the reaction of what it means for Inter Miami? Because the names people had us talking about on this show for the last 12 months were Luis Suarez and David Silva and
Cavani, yeah.
All of these on the back ends of their career, but major international stars mainly coming from Europe. Roger Martinez at 25 coming from Liga MX isn't that profile.
Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest problem that Miami suffers from, is the expectation for Miami is to have the very biggest names that you could possibly have in MLS. And, you know, it starts with Messi and Ronaldo, and everyone convinced themselves that Messi and Ronaldo were going to play together in Miami. And so every other player seems like peanuts, right? And then you, like you said, you rattled off some of the names, Cavani early in their first kind of offseason, the beginning of last year. And David Silva has been the name that's been, you know, battered around most recently. And, you know, every single possible name. I mean, I put together a list at one point because I was going to do an interview with Paul McDonough. And I just read off a list of like 15 megastars that I found on a cursory Miami MLS Twitter search were linked to be in discussions with Miami, because it's that ridiculous. And most of them are not true. There, of course, there's different levels of truth. Some of the players Miami had discussions with about the possibility of it. And when you talk about those discussions, I mean, there are always going to be these early conversations of approaching a player who maybe is coming out of contract soon or something. Would you be interested in MLS? What would the price look like? To get from that level to actually happening, there are so many steps that have to happen. But let's just say some of these have a little bit of truth to them. Some of them have none. And as a result, you have a 25-year-old player coming in his prime from one of the top clubs in Mexico who plays for Colombia, often starts for Colombia, and he's a disappointing signing based purely on the fact that he's not a name. And, you know, it's so funny because all you need to do is look in the last couple years at the teams that have been successful and tell me, like, how many people were excited about Miguel Almirón? Now, that's a flash in the – I mean, this guy was, like, one of the greatest signings in MLS history because they got the right player at the right price at the right time, who is just a transcendent level player, and went on to the Premier League. But no one was celebrating Joseph Martinez. And no one was celebrating Diego Rossi. They didn't know who these guys were, and they've become, you know, really impactful star players in this league. And so, you know, Miami is just at a point now where the excitement's going to have to come on the field. When this Martinez signing gets over the finish line, it's going to come down to if he can score goals and, you know, sliding from more of a winger at Club America into a number nine spot, probably with Miami, if he's bagging goals, no one's going to be complaining anymore. And we're going to see a player that has the potential to be one of the top finishers in the league.
Looking at Miami's roster overall, they have been maybe more on the wait and see side as well. And you talked about a number of reasons that potentially that could be a part of that makes their transition a little different than other expansion teams. But I remember back, LAFC took a little while to develop the roster as well. Do you see them trending more that direction, or do you think that maybe the expectations overall should be tempered a little bit for this club?
No, 100%. In fact, I spoke to Paul McDonough, and he, for a story I did a couple weeks ago on kind of the different approaches between Nashville and Miami, and he referenced exactly what you just said. He looked at LAFC and how they had done things differently than what he did with Carlos Bocanegra and Darren Eales in Atlanta. You know, that was kind of a done very quickly. That roster was put together in a short period of time. And LAFC, John Thorington, Bob Bradley, they kind of took their time, and they wanted to make sure they had the right players at the right prices at the right times, and that roster was kind of coming together in mid to late January. And that's what I expect we'll see with Miami. I think that they have several international signings that they're working on at different levels of completion that will be announced in the coming days and weeks, and we'll get a better picture of what this roster is going to look like. And I think when those signings are done, we will see a team that's going to be competitive in the Eastern Conference right off the bat. Remember, we still have two DP spots that are open that Miami is going to be filling. I know they're working on multiple TAM signings that are going to be a part of this roster. You know, a lot of the starting lineup, I believe, is not yet on the roster, has not yet been announced, a good chunk of the starting lineup. So I think we'll be talking about this Miami team differently by the end of February than we are right now, because I do expect to see kind of a flurry of announcements over the next few weeks.
Extra Time has a lot of TAM signings, but we only get one designated player, and that is Paul Tenorio of The Athletic. Always bringing the good stuff, Paul. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much. You can only say that when Doyle's not on the show, because then he's just, there's the other DP right there.
Especially now.
And Kalen, you're like the Zlatan. You're popping in for like a one season, one episode thing, and then you move from TAM to the real DP money, and then you go on and do your videos.
Yeah.
Want to say while you're here, by the way, loved the video you did in Costa Rica. My people, they deserve more attention. It was awesome. If you haven't checked it out, people listening, go check it out.
Boom. Love it. Anders, don't cut that from the show, man.
Pura Vida, there it is. Thanks so much, Paul, and have a good one.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Paul.
All right, well, Paul Tenorio sort of just said it there, Kalen. In his mind, most of the starting lineup isn't done yet. In Miami, he's not worried. He's not disappointed. Do you agree?
Yeah,
do you feel similar?
Well, I think if you feel a lot better hearing that there's going to be a flurry of signings, because in some places you're wondering, all right, where's the noise coming from? And Paul, as we've noted, usually doesn't get these things wrong. But I think McDonough really is the figurehead here. And in some ways, I think the expectation was because of Miami, and he hit the nail on the head on that with Beckham and the big names. But then you also think maybe it's going to be exactly the way he did it with Atlanta. And it's not. I think McDonough is actually referencing LAFC, so he's taking pieces of both. But the thing you learn from Atlanta that I'm sure he would carry forward is exactly to his point, Almiron, you didn't know who he was. But if you show up to an Atlanta United game, you could have never watched a soccer match before, and you watch Miguel Almiron play for 10 minutes, and you're like, who's that guy?
Right.
Who is that? And that's the type of signing that I think Miami and this like sort of new wave of MLS is like, You're building stars, you're winning, you put a good product on the field, and people show up.
But Atlanta is a different market than Miami, right? That's been the conversation for a lot of people, has been Miami's a city that shows up for LeBron. They don't necessarily show up for a Heat team that's good, playing hard because, you know, they work hard and all that stuff. Do you think a 25-year-old like Roger Martinez, and we do have to note, he's a Colombian international, huge Colombian community in Miami that you'd be tapping into with this, or in the Miami area. Do you think those types of signings that Atlanta did, the way Atlanta built of just being exciting on the field but maybe not big names off it, do you think that's enough for Inter-Miami to be successful?
I do, and I think it's a different profile. NBA, you know, it's all about the star power, and maybe the fan base relies on that, but I think MLS, it's a different thing. And I actually even question a little bit about this idea of a third DP and some of that idea of it necessarily being limiting as far as the signings you make. It's more saying encouraging teams to get the profile right, because as we've seen with Rooney, or as we've seen with guys, they've been fantastic. But I feel like the lifespan of that signing is short from a financial standpoint, and also from an interest and a connection standpoint, where I think going this younger direction and continuing to get young players that are changing the league are changing it in a more sustainable, better way, where the product on the field is something that you can watch for longer.
The other thing you get to do is you sell that player, and then you buy another player, and there's another big signing and more excitement, and the cycle continues to go, and it keeps people enthralled. It's exciting to see what's going on, and of course, for Inter Miami, they did have the first and third pick in the MLS Super Draft, which was hosted on ESPN by Adrian Healy, as well as Taylor Twellman and the star himself, Matt Doyle, who is home. Cortisone shots have been had. He is going to gut through this Willis Reed style to come on this show and assist us. Matt, you're a legend. Thanks for coming on.
I am having my Willis Reed moment, I guess. I'm toughing it out. No cortisone shots were necessary, though.
What people don't know is Willis Reed hit his first two jumpers, didn't play the rest of the game. Walt Frazier won that game, Clyde the slide. But going back to this other thing, we did some rumors at the beginning of the show. They were from Sam Stachel, not Paul Tenorio, so they're rumors, not reports, about how you got injured. I said fell off a treadmill or tripped because you were avoiding your cat and you have a very cluttered apartment. I don't know that. I'm just speculating. Mm-hmm. How close was I to the reality?
Well, on Saturday, actually, I was on the treadmill, and I did nearly fall off. So I avoided disaster earlier in the afternoon, but now the injury was a late night, mildly inebriated, trying to relive one's youth in the pit type of injury, and it didn't go well. Stuff you can do at age 23, you shouldn't attempt it at age 43.
So normally you have the, like, this player can't ski in their contract. For Doyle, it's no moshing during season.
That's amazing. I was going to say, my third guess was don't walk and tweet at the same time.
Yeah, that's actually what it would have been, a solid one.
Yeah.
Doyle walks into the street while tweeting fire takes about a super draft pick and potentially gets hit by a car.
That would have been way more respectable than what actually happened. So, yeah.
Can we go into the draft a little bit?
Before we do that, I just want to say Doyle, showing his age, not just in the injury, but he keeps hitting the buttons on the phone right now like your grandparents do when they're talking to you. So, Doyle, just watch out for that a little bit. But, Kalen, go for it.
No, I wanted to hear about your experience on the draft. Great job, I thought.
ESPN talent, Matt Doyle.
I was going to say, yeah, absolutely. I thought when you show up at first that you were just too big time to come in.
Yeah.
This studio's a little smaller than what I'm used to these days. I need handlers. But, what was that experience like? And what can we expect from this draft class or the draft in general? Because the concept of it with homegrowns is changing. There's a lot of talk about that. But how do we evaluate this class in particular?
We don't yet. I think that's the big thing that we should all have like taken away from the draft over the last 5 or 10 years. Like, you don't get, if you think about this great Sporting Kansas City team of the past decade, like, they built that team through the draft, and guys like Matt Beisler, Roger Espinoza, Graham Zusi, like, they're identified earlier and they're in MLS one way or another before they're even going to college soccer. So I don't think that it's not that these kids aren't good. There's still some really good, like, there are, I think, three kids who have potential national team future, U.S. national team, then at least one with a Canadian national team future. But the jump is just so much bigger now than it was 10 years ago. And I think the best example to use is the 2017 Super Draft. Because if we were sitting here having this conversation a year ago, we would have considered it a bust. Miles Robinson barely played. Jackson Ewell, who knew? Jonathan Lewis barely played. You go on, I mean, Lalas Abubakar looked like he was going to be a fourth center back. Jack Elliott was, like, not even a thought. Neither was Brant Bronico. And these are all guys you're looking at now. Like, these guys are starters, some of them absolutely, like, at the apex in MLS. You don't judge a draft until at least 2, sometimes 3 years are gone, because it just takes longer, I think, for most to acclimate to the pro game from college.
So every once in a while, though, you'll have a Kyle Larin, a guy who hits the ground running, is the guy. Robbie Robinson, first pick in this draft, as many people expected, forward out of Clemson, got to FaceTime with David Beckham, something that he will be potentially mocked for by his friends for the rest of his life because he handled it maybe not as well as he handles a ball in the 18. Do you expect him to be a factor this year? Do you expect anyone in the top few picks to be a factor this year?
Yeah, I definitely think Robinson and Neal. Well, I think Nealis is maybe the best bet to start out of all these guys. The number 3 pick, Dylan Nealis. He's an attacking right fullback. He's a lot like Keegan Rosenberry, who, of course, also came out of Georgetown. And if you look at Miami's roster, I think that's one of their weaker spots. With Robbie Robinson, I mean, he's a center forward. Now, they also think he can play a little bit of wing, and he's an assassin in the box. He can score every which way, but he's going to be competing with Matias Pellegrini, Julian Carranza, Juan Agudelo, probably Roger Martinez, Jerome Kiesewetter. Like, I don't expect him to start. Now, if he goes out there and he does what Kyle Larin did in 2015 in preseason, okay, like, he'll have earned the job. But, like, just think about the level of players you're competing against. It's tough to say, yeah, he's ready to walk right in.
We saw Daryl Dike, a Generation Adidas signing who had a lot of buzz, drop a little to the fifth pick. Saw Miguel Berry drop to the seventh pick. Is there anyone lower down that you're excited about or you think, I guess this is hard to say and not fair, but would be the next Julian Gressel?
I mean, it is tough because what Gressel did in 2017, you don't see that anymore. I think relative to the position, again, Dylan Nealis can maybe be like an Andre Shinashiki, last year's Rookie of the Year. He could be like that type of player where he walks in and gives you 1,800 really good minutes and looks the part of a professional player. I do think Ryan Raposo, the Canadian winger who went number four to Vancouver, he might have a chance because, Vancouver, they're going shopping, but we all know they're not going to go shopping to the extent that like Miami or Atlanta are. And they're very light on wingers, and this kid can play. If you watch him in the open field, like he is just a lethal finisher, really quick, can pass the ball as well. So he has a chance. And then DK is the interesting one to me because I just love big target forwards who can play with their feet. And like DK checks all those boxes. He reminds me actually of like a young Connor Casey from 20 years ago. And Connor Casey, for those who don't remember, like when he was a kid, after his freshman year, I think at college, he went and signed in Germany and he was tearing it up in the two Bundesliga. And then he was starting to get minutes in the Bundesliga as a youngish guy. And then the injury sort of hit and robbed him of his athleticism. I think DK is that same type of guy. He's a monster with his back to the goal, but he's got good soft feet. He's got patience. He creates plays. What he doesn't do, and that what Robinson does, is like he's just not. He's a little too passive in his runs in the 18. Like he needs a little bit more Joseph Martinez in him. He needs to get to the near post. Just work. I don't want to say work a little harder, but like go with a little bit more conviction and do those striker type things, those number nine type things. If he does that, he might win a starting job as well. And then one more I'll shout out.
Go ahead.
Patrick Segrist, the left back from Marquette. I've seen him play once. I don't know if he's good or bad, but he got drafted by the Red Bulls and they traded to draft him. And nobody works harder at making their draft picks into professional players than the Red Bulls do. So if they actually traded up to get this kid, that tells you they think they see something there that they can mold into probably a starting caliber MLS left back. And by the way, Kamar Lawrence, not very happy this winter.
Yeah, it so much of it does still depend on where you end up landing. And DK is going to have a lot of options, maybe not a sure one, but obviously with Dwyer still going to be there. Yeah. They got Benji Michelle, Santiago Patino at a nice moment in his rookie season as well. Interesting aside here, I saw that four of these draft picks, Raposo, Alistair Johnson, Niall Higgins, and Deion Harris, all club teammates. They all played on the same club team in suburban Toronto.
Yeah,
they're from Vaughan Soccer Club, so that's pretty impressive. I asked Alistair if they just crushed teams.
Yeah.
They did. This team, four first-round draft picks from the same club. I mean,
I think it's the historically like Italian neighborhood outside of Toronto, and it's like a soccer legend. I thought you were going to say something about Cal, so I'm really glad it went that way, because I was like, ugh, I forgot that he went to a college he cares about. Blah, blah, blah. Doyle's just out here repping Georgetown the entire show. Doyle, with your injury, we've had you become a reporter for a few minutes. You went on a conference call with U.S. Soccer to announce Brian McBride, a great center forward himself, to be the new GM of the USMNT under Ernie Stewart, so parallel to Kate Margraf. What did you learn from this call? What's the role? How do you think McBride fits in?
It's interesting. It seems like 95% of his job is going to be traveling to Chelsea to, be in touch face to face with not just Christian Pulisic, but like Frank Lampard and the decision makers at Chelsea. And then you travel to Schalke, and then you travel to Dortmund, and then you travel to Werder Bremen, and you just make the rounds. It's going to be like a full-time on-the-road type of job for Brian McBride to make sure that the lines of communication are open and that when Greg Berhalter needs to call in his best players, that there's no pushback from the clubs. And I went into the call pretty skeptical, because, like, why would you be anything but skeptical when it comes to U.S. soccer these days? But I came out, like pretty assured that there seems to be, a vision in place to make things function more smoothly. And whether or not Brian McBride is the right guy for that, it remains to be seen. But one of the things Ernie Stewart was kind of hammering on was, like, look at this man's credentials. We saw him score goals in two different World Cups. He was captain for the U.S. national team. He was a captain for Fulham. He's been captain in MLS. Like, Brian McBride could walk into, the front office of any club in the world and sit down and have a face-to-face meeting and look anybody in the eye, and they'll do the same. So I think that actually made a lot of sense to me. What I was surprised by is with the org structure now, Greg Berhalter reports to Brian McBride. It's Ernie Stewart at the top, Brian McBride under him, and then Greg Berhalter and the staff reporting to Brian McBride, who's going to have the majority of responsibility, it sounds like, for also hiring youth national team coaches and then making sure that the style of play sort of filters down. This was big. It kind of snuck under the radar, and we all wondered, like, what's going on. But it felt like certainly a major step in Ernie Stewart's tenure as sporting director, and maybe one of the defining moments of this half decade for the U.S. national team. Because if this doesn't work, then we're right back where we were 3 years ago.
Yeah, but at the same time, Doyle, the way it's set up, it was too much responsibility on a coach. And that was one of the things with Klinsmann was,
Yep. Well,
he failed on the field, but now all of a sudden your entire structure is broken because one person got fired. And you look at the best clubs and FAs, and there's people above coaches who keep consistency, and coaches are allowed to focus on winning. And that's also what Greg Berhalter does best. Like, he's a tactics guy. He's not a, I'm going to change the structure of the game in this country for 50 years to come guy.
I think you're absolutely right. Though I do think that Berhalter's vision for how he wants the team to play aligns with both Ernie and Brian. Just going off the comments from today, and obviously the stuff that Ernie has said in the past, and to a lesser extent, the stuff that McBride has said in the past. And I absolutely think it was the right move to have this sort of stratification and some clarity and specificity in job descriptions. I'm just surprised it happened in the way it did. And with a relative lack of fanfare, just to, at the start of 2020, okay, here we go. It's a totally new organization. Good luck. It kind of caught me off guard.
So Doyle is shocked by competency that has occurred. One of the things you mentioned was McBride will be in charge of hiring youth national teams. About 2 weeks ago, Jason Christ was the only youth national team coach on the boys and men's side from U12 all the way through U23. Now Anthony Hudson has been named U20 U.S. Youth National Team manager, and there's rumors that Larry Sunderland could be announced as the U17 national team coach to replace Raphael Wicki, who went to the Chicago Fire. What do you think of the rumor and Anthony Hudson, and what do you think of what McBride's going to do down the road with these national youth groups?
I mean, it's tough to get behind the Anthony Hudson hiring. I know he has experience at younger levels with Bahrain and New Zealand, but it was such a disaster for Colorado. It's pretty discouraging. Larry Sunderland, we've all seen the reports from Ivis that he's going to be the U17 head coach, and he has a good rep, but we've also seen reports saying that that's not actually the case. They did say on the call that there will be multiple youth national team head coaches announced soon, one maybe even as early as today. I don't know who it's going to be. I don't know if it's the U17s or something lower or higher. But it still is all kind of a mess. And that's why I think getting another layer in there at the GM level to be a decision maker, that it does make sense, but it also feels like, boy, we've been just sitting on the bike, sort of pedaling in the same spot for a few years now.
I think Sunderland would be a good hire, and McBride would know him well because Chicago guy was in the Chicago Fire youth staff when both of us actually were playing for the Fire. So those two will know each other well. But I think that's another part where McBride has this sort of breadth of experience. Of course, the credibility from playing, but I think the breadth of experience and relationships both abroad, it's rare to find somebody that's going to understand the youth level and all of the youth coaches in America, as well as be able to walk into a Chelsea and talk to Frank Lampard. Those are two very disparate worlds. So I think McBride being able to kind of mesh those two things together, the role seems to fit.
The next big thing coming forward, Doyle, last thing, and then we'll let you go nurse yourself back to health for a little bit more before we see you here on Thursday. Because, Doyle, I'm leaning on you right now. Right now, I think it's you and me for Thursday. So we'll see. Maybe we'll go ESPN and just get you the helicopter and just parachute you straight in as you've so rightfully deserved at this point. Is,
I agree with that.
Last thing coming up is Olympic qualifying. We got the draw at the end of last week for the men's side. The women's side starts in about 2.5 weeks. That'll be at the full national team level. On the men's side, though, U23 competition for qualifying. The U.S. has not qualified for the last two Olympics. They got drawn into a bit of a group of death in Group A with Mexico, Costa Rica, and the Dominican Republic. Just take us through, because we got a bunch of questions in the mailbag. Who are maybe a few of the guys that you think are keystone for this team? How are they going to look? What's qualifying going to? How is qualifying going to go?
Well, I mean, part of McBride's job is going to be to try to get some of the European-based players, because I don't like with the way qualifying is. European teams are not required to release U23 players. So Christian Pulisic's eligible. Tyler Adams, Weston McKennie. These are all guys who couldn't and should, Josh Sargent, could and should be starters for this team, but who knows if we're going to get them. So it could end up coming down to like a very MLS-heavy type of roster. You know, Mason Toy or Jeremy Abobase as the forwards. Guys like, you know, Jonathan Lewis and I guess Brooks Lennon as the wingers. So you have to kind of go down the list and one of the things that Jason Kreis is probably going to have to do is get these guys to play with a little bit of a chip on their shoulder. You got to go down to Guadalajara. You got to get a result against Mexico. You got to beat Costa Rica. And you got to get the job done in the semifinals. If you get there, nobody thinks you can do it. My guess is that's going to be the approach that, that Jason Kreis takes. But the good news is like, and again, this was from the phoner that McBride did. 15 Olympic-eligible players played for the full national team this past year. Now, granted, not all those guys were great, and not all those games were great. But, like, we're talking about Jackson Ewell, Miles Robinson, guys who can really – Paxton Pomykal, guys who have shown in big moments for club and country that they can get the job done. And those a lot of those guys, by the way, are with the full national team right now down in Florida – for this January camp. And my guess is they're kind of breaking that camp up where it's the U23 eligibles and the full senior, the older guys, so to speak, going head to head, because the U23s need to get as many reps as possible. We've seen it each of the last two cycles. Qualifying for the Olympics is not easy.
Doyle mentioned it. This will go down March 20th, starting down in Guadalajara at Estadio Akron and Jalisco in the big city. And of course, the last two cycles have been a little bit of a nightmare. The Sean Johnson game against El Salvador, and then, of course, knocked out by Colombia in an intercontinental playoff in the last Olympic qualifying. So we hope it goes better this time. But based off Doyle's luck so far in 2020, nothing bad could possibly happen to us, U.S. soccer and all going forward. Doyle, enjoy the rest of your day while you're working, quote-unquote, from home.
Yeah, I'm going to act my age. Thanks, guys.
Our thoughts, of course, go out to Matt Doyle. We hope for his best because we need him back at his peak athleticism where he is unathletic.
Yeah.
You brought up men's league injury. Like, the closest Doyle's come is he come and watched my co-ed games and mocks me for being sort of athletic.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you came to drink at a co-ed soccer game in the middle of New York City. I don't know that you get to mock me, but he is our man, our UConn legend, Doyle himself. He mentioned the 2017 Super Draft when he was talking about the Super Draft, being able to judge later on. One of the big names out of that draft was Julian Gressel, picked in the top 10, but lower down on that list by Atlanta United, immediately a starter, has led the club all time in assists at this point over their short time as a club. And then there's been a lot of rumors, a lot of rumblings that he wants a new contract. They've been delaying it. They say they love him, but he doesn't feel it. The rumors last week were that Toronto FC was actually looking at maybe trading for his rights, which both have denied. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that a guy who's just been so successful, any money you go out to spend to replace Julian Gressel with, you're looking for the exact production you get from him. Why not just give this guy the money and just say, we're thankful for what you've done and just get it done?
Well, that's like the...
come on, it's easy.
Always the question, right? But I think some of it actually does come from, all right, he started at the draft. He wasn't a foreign signing. He wasn't a big signing. And so now it's like, okay, you understand his perspective. And also, I think some of it also comes from this idea, and it's like, is he great because Joseph Martinez is great, or is Joseph Martinez so great because of Julian?
It's a system we could plug anyone in.
I totally disagree with that. And I think, you know, they would be smart to lock this down as soon as possible. And hopefully there are some conversations happening behind the scenes to make it work, because, I wouldn't be surprised if more teams like Toronto, smart teams, are starting to sniff around a little bit and say, how real is this?
And then you look at this year's draft and you're going to say, in 3 years, our guys consistent MLS starters. But as you said, they're not flashy. You know, they're not a new signing. Do they then move and end up somewhere else? That's where you look at a guy like Dax McCarty, who then goes on to be a legend somewhere else. Like, there's still talent in these groups, but perception sometimes affects the way front offices deal with them. For Atlanta United, they've got some work to do. They have to replace a center back. Leandro Gonzalez-Pires, who was one of the faces of this team alongside Julian Gressel, he's now gone. He debuted for Cholos Tijuana on Friday night in League MX, which, by the way, had five former MLS players play in that game between Santos, Laguna, and Cholos, which I thought was pretty interesting. But he debuted, he gets the start. He's a huge part of what Atlanta United's done. And then all of a sudden, poof, out of nowhere, it felt like he's gone.
Yeah. I think Miles Robinson's emergence
makes
that a lot easier, because this is a guy that you're going to be able to build around for a long time. And as he continues to grow, you just see his importance only growing with that group. And I think some of it also may come down to, I know there was comments, I think, in an Athletic article about it wasn't on bad terms, but there were rumors about how happy he was throughout the season. He came out publicly and made some comments as well to voice his displeasure on the system and then where they're playing. I think some of it's pretty simple, right? You have so much success early and you're under one manager, Tata Martino. This is the guy that connects with him, brings him in there. They have all the success, and then a new manager comes in and maybe the changes don't really go the way you want them to. And then also at times with this young stud coming up and emerging more as maybe the centerpiece of this new system that's coming forward. So in some ways, maybe it made it easier to allow both parties to go in their own way.
But Nagby gone, LGP gone, there are some huge holes for Atlanta United to fill. We know that Fernando Meza, coming from Liga MX himself, an Argentine 29-year-old center back, will be one of the people trying to replace LGP, but it's not going to be easy. Let's talk a few more moves, and then we'll get out of here. BWP, one of the best goal scorers in MLS history, not re-upped with Red Bulls. It's rumored that he will train with LAFC this week to see maybe that's a signing that they make. What do you think of the Dwayne Wade to the Cavs late on in your career, just ring chasing, being that guy move?
I don't know if ring chasing is fair, but I think it's very rare you could say from a player of his age that it is a high ceiling, zero floor signing to me. Because the ceiling is that you put Rossi and Vela around him and you put him in the box and you allow his movement and know-how to show. And the floor is literally nothing. I mean, he's going to be an excellent guy to have in that locker room. You know, Bob Bradley's all about culture. He's a guy I could see staying with the organization.
Right.
I mean, his imprint on a team, we saw the way he handled it with those young strikers with the Red Bulls was immense. And so you see Robles going to Inter Miami, what he's going to bring to that locker room. I think BWP could do that, but it just really comes down to his health. It was last year an aberration where he just couldn't get healthy, and he still has it, or are the health problems serious enough? And that's what these preseason are really about getting him in, seeing how he moves, and seeing what it looks like.
Of course, his best days under Jesse Marsh. Bob Bradley, of course, Jesse Marsh's mentor, so they'll know each other very well, and that's all for us. We've gotten to know each other very well. Kalen, I thought it was a great show between the two of us. We'll try and bring some of the injured party back into the fold if we can get a few minutes of training under their belts over the course of this week, but we'll update you, of course, on fitness levels throughout the press conferences during the week. Thanks all of you out there for listening, for watching, and have a great day.
We'll be right back.